met the other day. And what we tried to do this week was to set the stage for an understanding of the gospel promise as Abraham heard it in terms of the Exodus experience that's spelled out in the book of Exodus. Now, to perhaps understand this better, it would be good to just for a moment recapitulate and look at a few of the things that we said on Wednesday. First of all, we indicated that the promise was that power of God set in motion to overcome the curses that had become rampant in the world, and that the figure of Abraham and his seed were to be the vehicles through which that blessing was to be, one, evident in their own history, and two, mediated to other peoples. That above all, they were to become a name and a nation that was to demonstrate the grace and the goodness and the power and the blessing of God. That they were to receive a land that was a gift of grace, and above all, the history of the patriarch shows that they did not deserve that land, but that the land was indeed a promised land, a land of promise and of grace. And that somehow, through this people, there would be a way in which the blessing would affect the fate and the destiny of the lives of other nations and peoples around them. Or more particularly, in the words of the text, that all other peoples or families of the Adama, that is the ground, the Adama from which man came, from which Adam came, and which was in some sense cursed because of man before the time of Abraham, that somehow those people on the cursed Adama would receive the power of blessing. And that promise is set in motion. And throughout the stories of the patriarchs, it is really a kind of testing to see whether or not the patriarchs will believe such a ludicrous promise, since they are, after all, just a handful of wandering semi-nomads. How could it be possible that such a handful of people who were really not a people at all could receive the kind of blessings and be the mediators of the kind of divine plan of salvation that is being suggested here? And so time and again you will find this particular rendering of the patriarchs in Genesis that I've been working with demonstrating that the patriarchs are really a bunch of sinners of the first water. He does not whitewash Abraham or Isaac and Jacob. No, he certainly doesn't whitewash Jacob. Jacob's very name means, as I mentioned, it means in good English, a fink. As such, the whole story of how Abraham passes the blessing on is rather fascinating. Or that Isaac passes the blessing on. Isaac intended to give the blessing, it says, to Esau. But Rebekah, who was one of the greatest political figures of the patriarchal era, schemed in a remarkable way to get the promise. And that the promise is handed down to Jacob, who surely was not the one who deserved it, if one counts in terms of obedience to the parents. Jacob gets the blessing by means of the trickery and the scheming of Rebekah. Jacob lives out the very nature of Rebekah as a schemer, in a sense. And then quits because he realizes that his brother Esau is about to clobber him. But he goes with the sense that God has somehow or another given him the blessing. No real realization of what it meant. And yet somehow, as this schemer and this thinker that he was, after having tricked Esau twice, once with the birthright and the other time with the blessing, goes to visit his cousin Laban, who, quite parenthetically, the name Laban means whitey, which is a very fascinating kind of fact that quite a number of the names of the biblical figures have color designation. Laban means the white one. And the trickery that goes on between those two people is almost a parable in itself. I won't go into it. Simply point to the fact that at the end of that whole cycle in the middle of that whole cycle, Laban says, you know, I wouldn't have known. Indeed, I wouldn't have realized that you are the mediator of this blessing unless it had been that somehow it had been revealed to me, because I am being blessed on account of you. Verse 27 of chapter 30. Laban said, if you will allow me to say so, I have learnt by divination, which is not, of course, usually the biblical way of doing things. That's, you know, by you looking at livers and finding out what's happening in the future and things like that. I've learnt by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you. Now that whole motif that somehow blessing is mediated to other peoples around Jacob and his descendants because of what he does is a normative and significant part of the promise program. It's a programmatic dimension of the promise. And we'll keep seeing that element come in at perhaps the most unexpected places. Now Jacob returns from his encounter with Laban, and at that point, it seems, the understanding of what the promise is all about begins to sink in. And the direction towards its function in the Exodus story begins to become clearer. When he comes back and he's scared to death of meeting his brother Esau, which is very natural, and so he should be after what he had done, he comes back and in chapter 32, have two incidents that are important. Starting with verse 9, Jacob comes back and he starts to pray, which is first time he's really done any of that. The rest of the time he's been having quite a time out there in Haran with his brother and all of his two wives, and you know the whole problem he had of getting the right wife at the right time and all that. In verse 9 he says, O Lord, you said, return to your country and your kindred and I will do you good. Now I'm not worthy of all of the good love and the faithfulness you have shown to your servant, because I crossed only with my staff, and now have come back two companies, or two tribes. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and slay us all and the mothers of the children. But you said, now this is the beginning of the function of the promise as the means of blessing and of deliverance. You said that you would do me good, that your descendants would be as the seashore, that they could not be numbered. As he comes back, the ground upon which he can ask for divine deliverance is the fact that God had previously made the promise. That's the power. That is the ground. That is the resource to which he can continually appeal. In a certain sense, put it right back in God's face and say, God, you promised. Now deliver me. And so the function of the promise as a means of deliverance, as a means of salvation, as the appeal keeps coming back again and again, both here and in subsequent texts. Well, you know the rest of the story of Jacob and how his descendants went down to Egypt. I'm not going to spend all time on the rest of that cycle. That's the key element to remember. There is one other wording of the promise that needs to be kept in mind. It's a little different wording of the promise, which says that God in this promise called the promise a covenant. Now usually covenant and promise are two different things, but in some of the traditions they really become synonymous. That is, an act of God where God binds himself to Abraham and his descendants unilaterally as his act, without any prior demand on the part of Abraham's sons to be obedient to very specific laws or stipulations or whatever, which is normally part of some kind of contract, but rather an act of unilateral act of divine grace. That term covenant is indeed used long before the time of Sinai, the Sinai covenant, to describe God's relationship even with the patriarch. Keep that in mind, because it plays a role in a little moment when I try to wrap everything up at the end. We turn quickly to St. Paul and how he handles the same stuff. Now, the Israelites go down to Egypt. Everybody knows that story, and I'm not going to spend time in it. What's important as we try to look at the promise at work in Egypt is to ask the question of how it was fulfilled and how the promise became as it were, the force that governed the course of history, the power that determined the fate of the people of God. In the first dimension of the promise, you remember, was that they would receive a lot of children. They would have lots of progeny. And that is fulfilled in Egypt, because under slavery and under oppression, they multiplied to a degree that they had never done before. And the promise of numerous seed is fulfilled, and is said so in so many words in Exodus 1. But the other dimensions of the promise were that they would somehow or another become God's people, that they would receive a land, and that they would mediate blessing to others. Now, none of that had yet happened, really. And so the time came when God would, in quotes, remember his promise, or remember his covenant. Whenever it says in the Old Testament, remember, it doesn't simply mean an intellectual recalling that something was in the back of our minds and we brought it back to the surface of our consciousness, but rather it means put into action what had previously been promised or affirmed. To put into practice, to put into action what had previously been promised. So now the promise of God is to be activated by what God is going to do in Egypt. And in order that this might happen, he needs a vehicle for his deliverance, for his fulfillment of the promise. And the man that is chosen is a very unlikely individual, a man by the name of Moses. Now, Moses is very unlikely on several counts. One is that he is a murderer and had murdered Egyptians, and that is hardly the kind of man that one chooses. That is, someone right out of prison is not likely to be chosen as your next president, even given a job in this society. This is the one that God chooses to be his vehicle of deliverance. The second reason why he is not a very likely choice is that he's been hanging around with the Egyptians and was surely tainted with their whole mindset. And why would the Israelites want to have anything to do with somebody who had lived in the other camp? And the third reason why he is unlikely is that apparently he had great difficulty ever saying anything. He is repeatedly spoken of as having an impediment in his speech, that he is uncircumcised, that he can't communicate, and that he's untrained in any of these things, and so he has to have somebody who stands beside him and talks for him, namely Aaron, in many of the texts. At least three reasons why this man would not be the person that you or I would ever choose. And Moses himself is very aware of that when God appears to him at the burning bush in chapter 3 and he says, all right, I want you to go and deliver my people. And Moses says, you must be mad, God. Why me? And God says, I'll be with you. And Abraham and Moses says in chapter 3 a little further on, well, I don't even know who you are. God says, shut up, I'll be with you. I am with you. I am who I am. And really, in a sense, that's the way the answer comes. And it begins to discern that there's a new character, there's something new about God that is happening. Now what happens here is that in the prelude to the Exodus event, we have the discernment that God is going to reveal something about himself that is new and distinctive. And that corresponds in some way to a new revelation, or is symbolized in the new revelation of his name. A new name appears for God at this time, which is coterminous with, which really is the sign of the new thing that God is doing. And the new name is the name that Jim has been using, but which we normally don't ever use in our worship, at least not in our liturgy as yet, is the name Yahweh. Now, Yahweh is the way that they apparently pronounce that name, which is the covenant name, the promise name, the Exodus name. It is very explicit in Exodus chapter 6, verses 2 and following, that that name was not known to the patriarchs. The patriarchs knew a very different name, a name El. Or El Shaddai, El, which means the great creator, the head of the skies, the god of the cosmic mountain. El was the name that also the Canaanites knew. That's the same name for their god. In short, the God of Abraham was the God of the forefathers, and the new name corresponds to the new revelation of what God was all about. Now, I could spend a whole lecture on what the Canaanites believed, and I enjoy that because it's one of my special subjects, and I enjoy it, and I, you know, the whole business with the fertility rites and everything else. It's very interesting. Now, more important for our purposes is to recognize that the new name Yahweh means something like, and what's so great about it is the name is that we really can't get a hold of it completely. It's both a revelation and a mystery at the same time. You read the scholarly works and you'll get 500 different interpretations of what the word Yahweh means. The simple answer that is given in this text is that it means that God is there in action. That God is with us to deliver. It is really an extension of I am with you, always with the verbal infinitive at the end of it, I am with you to do something. God is never just with us, which is one of the things that we kind of like to have. He's with us, and so we're not alone. Whenever the Bible says I am with you, it means I am with you for a purpose, with a direction, namely to rescue you, to deliver you, to heal you, whatever. Now the I am with, the God who gets things done, who delivers, is Yahweh. I hope I get that clear. This new name of God is not a name that was known to the patriarchs. This is something that comes through Moses in the process of the Exodus experience, that God revealed a new dimension to his being. It anticipates, in a way, the kind of new dimension of revelation that appears in the incarnation of Jesus Christ. It is consistent with the past moment modes of revelation, but it is really a radical new revelation. If that's true, then this point is crucial for the understanding of the history of God's people. Remember that it is grounded in the promise, and the promise is made real and meaningful in the light of what happens in the Exodus. Now, the promise that's connected with that new name, let me make it read the text clearly. The Lord God appeared, wrong verse, 6 verse 2. God said to Moses, I am Yahweh. Every time it says Lord in the Old Testament, almost every time, read Yahweh. I am Yahweh, I appeared to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob as God Almighty. Now, God Almighty is really a name. It's not simply an adjective, Almighty. It's really El Shaddai, El the cosmic God. But by my name, Yahweh, I never did make myself known to them. I established my covenant promise with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they dwelt as sojourners. Moreover, I heard their groaning, and I have remembered my covenant. And verse 6, therefore say to the people, I am Yahweh, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from their bondage and redeem you with an outstretched arm and great acts of judgment. I am Yahweh. So time and again you'll hear that expression, I am Yahweh, or I am the Lord. That means, remember that I am the one who has revealed himself distinctively in the events of the promise and the Exodus. As such you will know me. As such you will worship me. And a pause. In fact, I need a drink of water. Somebody could do that. I'm very dry this morning. Are there any questions? I just want to make sure that groundwork stuff is clear. I know I tend to move very rapidly. I want to make sure that people have grasped that. All right, now let me explain why Jehovah is there instead of Yahweh in many of the texts. We didn't really know what this was. Years ago, in the Hebrew Bible, the good old scribes had great difficulty with this word because nobody ever put any vowels there, and you have certain letters. In English they would be equivalent to J-H-V-H. See? J-H-V-H. Now you look at those letters, J-H-V-H, and you say, well, there's got to be some vowels with them. What vowels do we put with them? Now when the scribes and the cantors of the tabernacle and the synagogue started singing those words, that word, they never ever said it. Why? Why didn't they say that word, that special revelation name? Well, you know, yeah, you could sing, put some vowels to it, but why didn't they sing that word? Right, it was too holy. That was the holy name, the sacred name, and nobody could say it. And so every time they put that word, they came to that word, they read the word Adonai, which is the word Lord, the ordinary word like master, Lord. And they always read that word. So in order to make sure that the scribes or the singers read that word every time and sang that word, they put the vowels of the word for Lord onto those particular consonants. And so when a person came to it, he knew very well, no, don't sing the unholy name, sing a euphemism. You sing a circumlocution, a word that is not the holy one, but just an ordinary word, namely Lord. You know, we can say Lord without saying a specific name of God. It's a general word. And so the consonants were there with the vowels for the word Lord. And then when the good old Germans and others tried to translate that word, they came along and they just didn't realize the history of the thing and put the vowels of one word with the consonants of another word, and we got Jehovah. And Jehovah is really a non-name. It's a combination of two names, of two words, a name and the regular word Lord. It really means the same thing. However, to be more precise and scholarly, one should say Yahweh, which is what I like to do, but there's no point in going around changing all our hymns and say, Yahweh, guide me, oh, thou great Yahweh. It doesn't quite come out the same way as you, if you train it. But eventually there will be those who will incorporate the real form of the name, I think. That's the name. That's the revealed name, the special name that is the distinctive sign of the Exodus. Now, from that point begins the processes of how it was that God effected the deliverance for God, for his people, how the promise got put in motion. And in order for it to happen, there had to be a real conflict, really, between the gods of God of Yahweh and the gods of Egypt. Between Pharaoh as the authority on the one side and Moses as the representative of his Lord on the other. And so began the whole series of the plagues. Now, I'm not interested in how you explain all the plagues with a multitude of explanations, including some that Dale Hayworth has, apparently, from the point of view of Aegean civilization. What I'm interested in pointing out is that in the whole sequence of these plagues, there are indications of the effort to see how the promise was working even before the actual Exodus itself. With the plagues, there came also an awareness on the part of Pharaoh, time and again, that he was committing a great crime. And when he was aware that he had committed this great crime against these people, he repeatedly asks that Moses would intercede to forgive him for that crime. Look at 10 verse 17. Now therefore I pray you, forgive me only this once more, and pray Yahweh your God to remove this death from me. Now it's interesting that in a sense the mediation of the blessing, the mediation of forgiveness is requested by the person who is the oppressor. It's a very interesting text. And this happens several times in the course of this thing. Now, every time that Moses gives in and says, all right, we'll believe you, his heart gets hardened once again, and he goes back and continues his work. One little sidelight. The plagues are really, there are really several versions of the plagues inside the biblical text itself. One version is much more down to earth, and the other one is a much more magnificent. The plagues get bigger and bigger and bigger. There's this one little place that I just like to have a sidelight. It's really not particularly relevant, but I like a few sidelights once in a while to ease the tension. When the snake is thrown down, in the one version, the snake's thrown down, the rod is thrown down at least, and the snake crawls on the ground. And the word that is used there is the ordinary word for snake, you know, like an ordinary everyday snake that you've got here, whether it's a rubber boa or a copperhead or whatever. But in the other version of that same plague, when the snake is thrown down, or rather the stick is thrown down, it doesn't become an ordinary snake, but it becomes a huge dragon called Tanin, or Leviathan is the other version of that name. It's very interesting that really, it's no wonder Pharaoh in that other version got a little upset when he had all of these huge crocodiles or whatever it was storming around his palace and all over the empire. There are all kinds of variations within that that are very fascinating if you try to go into depth. There are whole pictures of, really, of symbols of what was going on. The dragons at work, the evil dragons that are approaching, in a certain sense, symbolizing what's going on. Now, at the end of these plagues, there comes the most important plague of all, the plague of the Passover. Now, that plague is really the act which initiates the Exodus. All of the others are but preludes that demonstrate that God was working and that the promise was in some way working. But every time that the thing didn't work, the people didn't believe. And the question is always whether or not Israel will believe that the promise could ever possibly work in the midst of such oppression. Faith in the promise was crucial. And every time it didn't work, they growled at Moses and screamed bloody murder because the promise wasn't working. Now, in the midst of that promise, and in the midst of that struggle, there are two different reasons as to why the people wanted to leave Egypt. One was simply to get out, and they said to Pharaoh, "Let my people go," which is the normal wording that we hear. In the other version, fascinatingly, it says, "We'd like to go for 3 days out into the desert to have a little festival, since it's that time of the year. A 3-day trip." Now, that is not quite the same kind of demand as the demand for a total release of all who are slaves to leave the country. It's a much more subtle kind of story in that version. And in that version, apparently they trick Pharaoh in terms of their escape. It wasn't a bold exodus. It was a picture in which they snuck out and tricked Pharaoh, and then Pharaoh says, "What on earth has happened?" Two interesting versions of this thing. What ultimately is involved is to recognize that the exodus event was the great hand of God that was affecting it, even if there were diverse ways in which that exodus was effected historically. Now, the Passover event is the key event right before the actual exodus itself. And in a sense, that Passover, which had all kinds of prior histories as a festival, comes to be the most important remembrance of how God rescued his people. Now, to understand that story, there are two different words that appear in the Hebrew. Two different terms. The word Passover can mean two different things. It can mean, one word that is translated Passover means simply to pass over the top of, and that's what the angel of death does. The angel of death, the destroyer it's called in Hebrew, the destroyer that God sends, comes and kills the firstborn. Now, blood is taken as the symbol of life and death and put on the doorways of the faithful, of the people of God. When the angel of death passes over, when the destroyer passes over, there's one word. The other word is a word which we often translate Passover, Pasach or Pesach. You'll hear the Jews use that term. That doesn't mean pass over the top of. That means to stand guard and deliver, to rescue, so that when the destroyer is passing by on the outside and killing the Israelites, Yahweh is present delivering Israel on the inside, at the door, so that Yahweh pasaks Israel, stands guard, rescues his people while the destroyer passes over. There are two sides to it. In a certain sense, the very Passover itself is a prototype, is a sign of what's going to happen later at the Red Sea. It anticipates that event. It indicates that God will indeed rescue his people, but the oppressor will receive the hand of judgment. That's all in chapter 12. But once the Passover has happened, and Pharaoh's firstborn child has been put to death, and he goes to the Israelites and says, all right, go. Go and do your worship. You can leave. There is a tie-up with the promise that is very interesting. Namely, he says, when you go there and worship your Lord, Yahweh, and you have your sacrifices, I'd like you to do one thing. Bless me too. Now that's a very interesting point, because the word bless is not simply just, you know, think nice things about it. And if you've listened to the whole point of the sequence, the blessing is to be mediated to all of those who are involved. Here the oppressor is asking for the mediation of blessing from the hands of those who are leaving, as they leave. And that the Egyptians are the first major power in the history of the mediation of blessing, through which blessing is at least hopefully mediated. Now, relations with other nations time and time again are likewise spelled out in terms of the salvation that is known and experienced in Yahweh by the Israelites is to be known and experienced by mediation to the other peoples as well. Then comes the Exodus event itself. And they leave. And the story of the crossing of the Red Sea is the heart of the controversy at Concordia Seminary right now. And I'm not going to tell you why it is that we're in trouble. That's a whole different story. Let me try and extract from the heart of that what happened at the Red Sea that is important theologically. At the end of this crossing of the Red Sea, or during the course of it, this is to be the place in which Israel discerns that Yahweh is their God. Let me read a couple of key texts out of the crossing itself, key verses. In 14 verse, well, I'll go back a little. 14 verse 3. For Pharaoh will say to the people of Israel, they are entangled in the land, and the wilderness has shut them in, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, and the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh. What was it? Israel was to know that I am Yahweh, and now in the victory at the Red Sea, all men, including those who are the pursuers, are to know that I am Yahweh. That the character of God will be revealed to all parties concerned in and through the Exodus event. To the Israelites, the word is spoken this way, verse 13. And Moses said, stand firm, fear not, and see the salvation of the Lord, the act of deliverance, and that he will work for you today. Now in this picture, the act is truly given to be an act of God. God takes the initiative. He stands there from his pillar of cloud and fire and fights against the Egyptians. Not simply with the water crossing. Actually, there are three or four different versions of what's going on here. The most important one is that God is the one who is the warrior fighting on behalf of his people and will defeat them. Will defeat the enemy on behalf of his people. He routs them, as it says, from the cloud. He puts them into total panic, and the enemy is destroyed. Verse 14, the Lord will fight for you. The picture is of God the warrior.
fighting to deliver his people down there in the midst of them. And you only have to stand still and watch it. Now, as a result of that whole victory and all the dimensions that are involved here, there is a concluding statement in Exodus 14. Thus Yahweh saved Israel from that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. And when Israel saw the work of Yahweh against the Egyptians, the people feared Yahweh. That is why we stand in awe of him, because we had seen him do that great event of deliverance and had fulfilled the promise that he had spoken. And against the Egyptians, they feared the Lord, and they believed in Yahweh and in his servant Moses. Faith is wrought in the hearts of the people of God in and through this event. Now, that faith surely was a very weak one time and again, because they growled and grumbled and said, "Why did you bring us out in the middle of the wilderness?" and so on. But the promise is fulfilled, at least in part. The first stages have begun. Israel has come to know that Yahweh is their God, and now he will spell out what that means in the covenant at Sinai in greater detail of how he is to be their God and live with them as his God, and they are to be his people. And he will lead them to the land which he has promised. But the full revelation of what kind of God he was is seen in those two moments, in the promise and the promise fulfilled through the Exodus. And all of this comes before Sinai, before the advent of all those laws which sort of set up the stage for the lifestyle under Yahweh. And they are more important than those laws that set up the lifestyle. They are primary. The gospel promise, the promise fulfilled in the Exodus, has priority. And in order to pull this together, one really ought to say that that's exactly what Paul says in Galatians 3. That there is the priority to the promise, and the revelation of God in the promise, and the promise fulfilled and being fulfilled, first in Abraham and in the Exodus and then in Jesus Christ. That promise comes long before the law, comes before Sinai. And it is in and through that word of deliverance, that promise of deliverance, that the true relationship between man and God is established. That men of faith are the true sons of Abraham, those who experience that word of deliverance are the true sons, and not those who are, by blood, heirs of the law, like those Jewish pastors of Paul that claimed that they were the only true sons of Abraham, because indeed they were those who had the law and were blood descendants of Abraham. It is those who have faith in the promise and what that means in terms of understanding the God as the God of the Exodus. That is what makes you a true son of Abraham and heirs according to the promise. We pause this.
No.
Yeah.
Could you say a little bit more specifically how the Exodus is fulfilled in the promise, and why, how? Could you just talk about that a little bit more?
The promise spelled out that there's several things. One is that they would receive a land, a destiny, and a name. Two, that they would be the mediators of the revelation of what God was all about. And in the connection with the first of those, it was only by means of the act of deliverance from Egypt that it was ever possible that they would get a land, part one.
Point two, it is in and through that event of the Exodus and the whole contingency of stories around it, you know, Exodus is more than just simply the actual exit as such, that the true character of God that Israel's was to mediate, the message about him that they were to mediate became apparent. And so at least in those two ways, the promise is fulfilled. It is fulfilled also in a sense in that Israel gains its identity. They are to become a name, a nation. And they become a name and a nation. They gain identity as a people in and through that ultimate experience that is part of the Exodus. So in those three ways, I would say at least, you can speak of the fulfillment of the promise as being taking place in the Exodus. Not the full dimensions of it, not that the promise ends there, as though it doesn't have other dimensions that need to be fulfilled, but it surely does in that extent.
One other question. Why Israel, from your point of view, why was Israel elected to be the one to fulfill?
Who, how odd of God to choose the Jews, as the old saying goes.
How do you understand that?
Why should God choose Israel?
Yeah.
And not the Canaanites,
or the
Jebusites, or anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's an answer to that question. I think that is one of the questions that has to remain unanswered. That God would choose, it's very clear in Deuteronomy that God's intent was not to choose somebody who was great and powerful. I chose you, it says, one, because you were the smallest of all the nations of the world. Remember that. That's one of the reasons, that you were one of the most insignificant. And I chose you purely because I loved you, and you certainly had no righteousness in yourself. That's why I would choose you. And you happen to be those unrighteous people in that day and age through whom I believed that I could reveal my purposes. That there was any, you know, reason historically why this should have happened is perhaps a different kind of question than the theological question. But at least those reasons are given from God's point of view as to why he chose them. In Deuteronomy especially, several such rationales. I chose you to be my special possession because I loved you, because I elected you myself. Not because you were greater or more righteous, but in order that you might be my wisdom and my righteousness and my blessing to others. Does that answer you?
Yeah, that answers.
But Norm, something you said the other day about the fact that a curse was put upon Canaanites, which would have made them sort of ineligible, seems to come true.
I've been thinking about the case for the Canaanites a little bit, not in terms of their destiny, but in terms of the difficulty of understanding the nature of Israel taking over of the land. There are some difficulties there. But that is one of the understandings as to why Israel could move in and take over the land, is that the Canaanites, as Leviticus puts it, had forfeited their right to the land because of their vile lifestyle and activities, and so the land vomited them up. And so the land will vomit you up, Israel, if you likewise live like they do. See, he makes that very clear. So that the curse could be reversed if Israel, by virtue of their lifestyle or their relationship with God, had negated their whole purpose and destiny as God's mediators of blessing and the mediators of the promise to other people.
In this connection, we have a comment on the fact that God hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Yes, it does. And well, I'm sure that those who want to find predestination there will find it there, not because they inevitably started from that point, but because they had another predisposed point of departure. The point of the hardening is to heighten the conflict to the degree that it was made very obvious that it was neither Pharaoh nor the Israelites nor the miracles, the lesser miracles, but ultimately only God who affected the Exodus event. And so it couldn't be the generosity of Pharaoh or the power of Israel or any of those other factors. The only factor ultimately, you see, that comes out as to how Israel got out of there was by virtue of God's great act. It wasn't the, you know, the generosity of the oppressor or anything else. It was entirely an act of God, and he was playing both sides in order to make it clear that he was the one who was doing the exodusing, the delivering. Huh? What?
Deliberating.
Okay, yeah. Same word. I need a new intent. Deliberating it. Okay? Any other questions? It's kind of important. And the point that Paul makes is really valuable, very important, is that one doesn't realize that Paul is really going back, in a certain sense, to the roots of the whole understanding of the Exodus and the promise, when he says that that comes before Sinai, and it has priority. And in that terms of that promise, we must see Christ as the ultimate fulfillment. He brings us back to the power of the promise that precedes Sinai, precedes the law, and that is the ultimate goal and the meaning of life. There it is to be found. And that we who have faith in Jesus Christ are heirs of the promise. Not those who are sons of Abraham by blood. All right. Any other questions? All right, God. All right. Shut up. Ha 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 ha!